Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So today our main topic is going to be x86 assembly. I'm mostly going to focus on things that don't come up in 3330. The reason we're spending time on this is that we're going to have assignments where you're going to need to deal with stuff where you don't have source code. So you should get pretty comfortable with that. You have this practice in 3330 with the BOM lab, but we only do the easy parts. And also, I'm going to talk about a few things which don't come up in that, like how executable loading works in a bit more detail and executable file format, since a bunch of the malware we're going to talk about is about modifying executables. So we need to know how executables work in order to know how that works. And then generally I'll try to focus more on things that they're coming in 3330, but we'll review a few things that people often might not remember well enough. Last time we talked about VMs, and I'd like to start off by reviewing and seeing if there are questions about what I talked about last time, since I probably went pretty fast through some really complicated things. And if you remember, our key things we were trying to get from VMs are configurability. That we have this nice consistent environment for you. That's why we're using it in this course, not because we're actually doing real malware analysis. People who do real malware analysis like it because it gives them isolation. They can run something dangerous in a safe environment and have a very good idea of exactly everything it touches. And this is because there's this relatively small interface that the VM implements that's everything that malware can do. And the key mechanism for implementing VMs was hardware support, that somehow we can arrange for the hardware to give the VM implementation, which I call a virtual machine monitor, control when it needs it. Whenever the virtual machine does something that the virtual machine monitor doesn't want to implement in, by just doing what the native machine would do. Yes? So this is asking about hardware support for VMs. So, and there's a BIOS flag to set it, to turn it on and off on some machines. I do not understand why that is not always on. My guess is that there's some compatibility problems with some operating systems which don't like that feature being enabled, or there's some people who might be worried about their OS surreptitiously being put inside a virtual machine. But it doesn't seem to make much sense to have that feature disabled ever. It's really inconvenient for people in this class who need to figure out how the heck do I get in the BIOS. But that's what it is. But that's enabling hardware support, in particular enabling hardware support for things like PopF was our example of something where the native sort of original 64-bit x86 and 32-bit x86 didn't support virtualization properly. They didn't give the virtual machine monitor control in all cases where it wanted it. And some people were a little unclear from my explanation about why this was a problem. So PopF, the problem isn't that it's privileged or not. The problem is that it does something different in user mode, the mode that we run normal applications and virtual machines in, and kernel mode. In user mode, it just silently doesn't change a flag. It reads the flag from the stack and ignores what its value is. In kernel mode, it actually changes it. And what the virtual machine monitor wants is to change a simulated value of this flag. It wants the virtual machine monitor to get a callback, which if this were a privileged operation, it would, because that would trigger an exception. The way where we've arranged that the virtual machine monitor gets control. But the way it works in user mode by default, it's not going to do anything. So if you just run this code, the virtual machine monitor doesn't know that the operating system it's running, the guest OS, tried to change this flag, and it's just going to silently do the wrong thing. In particular, this interrupt enable flag determines whether the guest OS, should expect to see one of its exception handlers run from IO. And so the virtual machine monitor might erroneously run one of its exception handlers, which would be an extremely subtle and difficult to debug bug. And the hardware support is basically adding a processor flag that lets the virtual machine monitor get control in this case, and several other cases like it. There's a bit more to it, but this is the most important part. And with that support, we have our normal way that VMs work, which is that you have real hardware give control to the host OS anytime any operation which should work differently in the virtual machine monitor happens. Yes?
Through the traditional VM structure,
yeah.
Not all of the privileged operations went through the M monitor.
It would be the case, not all the operations would, but all the privileged ones should. So like an add instruction, we would want to run directly on the real hardware. We don't want the virtual machine monitor to have to do something for every add. That would be really, really slow. But something like popf, which might change the privilege flag, we want to run the virtual machine monitor. And we had this alternative I mentioned, which was binary translation, which is what you do when your hardware doesn't help you. It's not preferable. But I'm talking about it because it's, in a sense, more powerful than relying on the hardware. With this sort of technique, we don't care if the hardware didn't decide to give us control on an instruction. We can still instrument it. And so there's other software, which isn't like a virtual machine exactly, which takes advantage of this. So here is sort of Valgrind, a couple people. So Valgrind, people mostly know as a memory error finder. But what Valgrind basically is a binary translation engine. And for finding memory errors, it does a binary translation where it modifies all code which accesses memory to check for errors. And these are the sorts of very invasive things we can do with this technique, which is valuable for analyzing software in general, including if you want to figure out what malware does or check for certain properties in code dynamically. And the basic idea, the way we can do this kind of practically, is that we translate the code in small segments, ending by returning to the translator, and we just speed this up by doing some caching and by replacing those returns to the translator with returns to code we already converted. So any questions on any of the virtual machine topics from last time? Comments? Yes?
Could you repeat the part about binary translation allows us to ignore the whole privilege problem with flag you had earlier?
Yeah, so we're taking machine code and translating it to new machine code. When I write whatever that does, whatever does that translation, I can choose any sort of effects for any instruction. I don't need to only deal with the instructions which are going to cause an exception, because my hardware designer chose that. So I have the right version of this example now. So for example, I can call, say, this checked add queue function for add. So I can change what adds do if I really want to, which is not going to be something we can do with the normal technique, because why would you want to get an exception on every add? And wouldn't that also be really slow? Because there's a lot of overhead to turning control over to the OS.
So you're choosing replacing these privileged operations.
So we're choosing replacing operations in general. We aren't limited to privileged operations.
But you're getting around the privileged operations by just substituting in new.
Yes, operations. Exactly. So in the binary translation way of implementing VMs, I translate the privileged operations to say just a normal function call. Yeah?
Does that change with the, what the overall code is trying to do, or do you use like an operation that
You have to be careful to translate into equivalent code. And this is a bit tricky because, for example, you might want to use some memory for the functions you're calling, and you need to make sure that doesn't interfere. But this is a manageable problem. So basically, a usual technique is you figure out some area of memory the real OS doesn't use, and make sure it doesn't use it, and use that for all your special stuff. Or you like add something to every memory address to make that not a problem. So implementing these binary translators is very tricky, but I want you to be aware of them just because they're tools like Valgrind, which are actually pretty easy to program things for, which let you do some very powerful ways of analyzing what software does. Any other questions? Comments? Okay, so on to the main topic of x86-64 assembly. As I said, the reason we're covering it is because your assignments will use it. Later on in the semester, when I talk about malware, I'm going to give you examples where I'm going to show you x86 assembly, typically 32 or 16-bit, but x86 assembly. So I wanted to make sure that you aren't just barely remembering things from 2150 and or 3330. And we're also going to talk about machine code, because we're going to be manipulating binaries. We're talking about how programs manipulate binaries, so it's good to have an idea how x86-64 machine code looks, which is shockingly messy. So a little history of x86-64. So you might think of this as the Intel architecture, but AMD came up with it first. So AMD had something they called AMD64, which was a 64-bit extension to 32-bit x86. So AMD at the time was one of the leading makers of processors for consumer PCs. And this was in a period where, partly because of AMD64, it looked like Intel might be in a lot of trouble, which is not something we think today, but that was the business aspect at the time. And part of the reason why it looked like Intel was in a lot of trouble is that Intel wanted to make a new instruction set architecture for servers. So they constructed something called Itanium. And Itanium was a radically new design based on a sort of a design philosophy for instruction sets called EPIC, which is based on something called VLIW. VLIW stands for Very Long Instruction Word. Which basically means you have bundles of instructions, which turns out to be more efficient for reasons which might come up if you take an advanced architecture class, considerably beyond 3330, or you can read up on. But so this was a big bet by Intel, and they wanted to also segment sort of the PC versus server market. This is focused on servers, and they made it for several years. I think they're still making some, but they're kind of winding down Itanium chips, but it wasn't very successful. People do not ask to run Itanium servers these days. The main reason it still exists is because Intel promised, for example, HP, that they would continue supporting Itanium for like over a decade. And they're stuck with that. So eventually Intel realized that this Itanium bet, this radically new architecture, didn't pan out, and that AMD's idea of being compatible with the old stuff was really important. So they copied what AMD did, and of course renamed it, because why would they use something called AMD64? They're Intel. So Intel had their marketing term, which was originally EM64T, for Extended Memory 64 technology. And nowadays they just call it Intel 64, because they probably want to pretend that Itanium doesn't exist. Even though that's historically, you might see, for example, some people call Itanium IA64 as an abbreviation for Intel Architecture 64, even though it's kind of not really a popular architecture for Intel to talk about anymore. So this is important because it gives us the idea of where the definitive source for information about the x86-64 is. And that's that Intel and AMD publish manuals. And for the most part, they copy each other well enough that these manuals exactly agree and are just two descriptions of the same thing. There might be some minor differences, but it's really, really small. They really care about, you know, being able to substitute for one another. So you should become familiar with these manuals. One thing I'd like to get you to be able to do in this lecture is be able to consult the actual definitive sources rather than looking for sort of sketchier sources like, which are less complete, like our textbooks or random things you find online. Because it's good to have the actual authoritative source for information and be able to use it. So this is the cover page of the Intel manuals, combined volumes 1, 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D, 3A, 3B, 3C, and 3D. You might guess that that's a little long. And the AMD has a similar thing. So you can download one big PDF file of the Intel manuals. It's 24 megabytes. It has a bit over 4,600 pages. You're probably most interested in the instruction set reference part of it, which is only 2,000 pages. And in alphabetical order, so you can look up an instruction pretty easily. So obviously, I do not expect anyone to read these from front to back, but these have all the information about how absolutely everything works, and they have an index. But they're not the easiest things to read. And the most useful thing for you probably is the instruction set reference. You might come across an instruction which doesn't make any sense, like loop, what's loop? Or move SD, what's move SD stand for? Who knows? Well, you can look it up in the manual. And you're gonna find a manual page in the instruction set reference that whose heading looks something like this. And this is a little intimidating. So, and there's also more information that's not shown, which is sort of like a text description. So up here, we have the various forms of this instruction, which is inc, for increment. Increment something by one. And we have the opcode. So the opcode is the opcode, just like you learned in other things, it's the part which encodes what instruction it is. And typically, this is basically at the beginning of the instruction. It's more complicated. We'll get to that later. And you'll notice that opcodes are variable length. There are also some other confusing things in here, like rex. That doesn't seem like hexadecimal to me. Why is it there? We'll talk about that probably next time. And some of these encodings do something weird, where the opcode includes the register number, which is what this indicates. RW means a 16-bit register, RD means a 32-bit register. And then there's the form of the instruction. Since this is the Intel manual, it's an Intel syntax. So destination first, since it's Intel syntax, not that it matters for this instruction. And they use this notation where r/m8 means an 8-bit value, either from a register or from memory. r/m32 means a 32-bit one, and so on. And r16 just means a 16-bit register. So then there's this other column labeled opn, which is just extra information about how it's encoded. We'll talk about what these things mean later, probably next time, not today. Then we have these two columns labeled 64-bit mode and compatibility/legacy mode. So this is a manual for both x86-64 and x86-32. And some of these instructions don't work in 64-bit mode. So not enabled, I think, is what that means. So you can't do these in 64-bit mode. And some of these don't work in 32-bit or 16-bit mode. So this form, for example, in this form, don't work in 32-bit or 32 or 16-bit mode. That's what that indicates. There's also this text description of what the instruction does, which usually is helpful. So any questions about anything on this page that I haven't touched? Yeah. So compat leg mode, this is 32-bit mode, basically. 32-bit or 16-bit mode. Does the instruction work in that mode? So something a little confusing here is that you see that we have the same encoding here for 16 and 32-bit. They just don't like indicating that which one is chosen depends on whether you're in 32-bit or 16-bit mode. But that's what that means. Since it's the exact same opcode, it's not that they, in the exact same way of encoding things, it's not that they're different instructions, it's just that there's a different interpretation depending on whether the processor's in 32-bit mode or 16-bit mode. Yes? I am not sure offhand. We'll talk about encoding more later. For the most part, you're not going to be encoding things by hand, so this is not so important. We'll have the assistance of actual tools to do that. I'm never going to ask you to do this on a test, because that's ridiculous, and knowing that detail about the x86-64 encoding is not that useful. It might mean that the opcode is actually like 1.5 bytes, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check. Okay. So after what I showed you on that page, there's usually other parts to these Intel instruction listings. So they're just a text description, which tells you in text what the operation does. And also, there's a section labeled operation, which gives you pseudocode for the operation. And for some instructions, the pseudocode is like pages long. There's also a list of flags affected. So for those people who didn't take 3330 or don't remember, flags are the things that like JNE uses. And it turns out that most x86 instructions change them, but not all. And if you want to know whether or not it does, you look up in the manual and see flags affected. It will tell you whether it changes those flags. So flags include things like the zero flag, which is used by JE and JNE to know whether something was equal or not. Equal to zero. You can look up the jump instructions to see what flags they expect. It also talks about exceptions, which is how can the OS be called from this? So even for this instruction, there's exceptions which can happen. The most notable one is that if this memory location here is not a valid one, that will cause an exception. And that's listed in the manual. Any other questions about things in instruction listings? Okay, so that's the main part of the manual you use. The manual covers everything else, but it's generally not in such an accessible form. So one thing you might know about x86 is that you have all these registers. We have RAX, RBX, RCX, RDX, and so on, up to R15. And I'll talk about this RIP thing later, which isn't really a register that you can access normally. But the rest of them are just general purpose registers, and they're divided into smaller registers. So RDX contains EDX, that's the lower 32 bits of the same register, and it contains DX, which is the lower 16 bits of EDX, and then it contains DL and DH, which are the DX register divided into two 8-bit halves. And so these are the names. You can look these up. I don't expect you to memorize that SPL is the name at the bottom of RSP, but these all have names that you might see. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how these overlapping registers work, because it's not quite intuitive and this comes up a bunch when you're reading assembly. So setting a 32-bit register always sets the corresponding 64-bit register. So if I XOR EAX with itself, so anything XOR with itself is zero, that in fact sets all of RAX to zero. So anytime you set the 32-bit register, it sets the upper bits of the corresponding register to zero. So this means if I move -1 into EBX, that sets RBX to FFFFFFF, 8 Fs, not 16. It's not sign extended, it's just filled with zeros. This is just the rule that AMD chose, and it stuck. And it's kind of a weird rule, because 16 and 8-bit registers don't work this way. Go figure. But you'll very commonly, when you read 64-bit code, see things that just set EAX and then use RAX, and it's confusing because didn't you forget to set something? But no, they didn't. when we look at the encoding, there's a better justification for what's going on here, namely that this XOR instruction is shorter to encode than the equivalent one with 64-bit registers. And that's probably the motivation behind this choice. Yeah?
So does setting a 16-bit register change the 32 bits, or just?
It just changes the 16 bits. So if you set the 16-bit register here, it leaves the rest unchanged. And EAX is just the this subset of it, too. Okay, any questions about this? Okay. So since most of you are in or have taken 30 through 30, you've seen AT&T syntax, and for consistency with 30 through 30 and my sanity, since I'm teaching that course, I'm going to be using AT&T syntax almost all the time. I apologize if you really like Intel syntax, but this is my preference. Hopefully for most of you it's more convenient since you'll have dealt with 30 through 30 stuff or are dealing with it. So this is your cheat sheet, which you've probably seen in 30 through 30 for how you convert between the two. In the case which is actually complicated, which is this, the full addressing mode that's supported for memory addresses, where you have a base plus an index times a scale plus a displacement. And the other big thing to remember, if you haven't remembered it before, is the destination is last. This is the easiest way I can misread code. So you should probably try to avoid doing that too. Constants start with dollar signs. Anything starting with a percent is a register. Even if you haven't heard of that register ever before, it's a register. And the other thing to remember is that we have an operand length specifier. So this is an AT&T syntax thing and not an Intel syntax thing. Intel syntax will write out something like Q word pointer or D word pointer to indicate the length. And this means that if you're looking up, say, move Q in the manual, you're not going to find it. You need to look under move. Same with like add Q, add L, et cetera. So just remember when you're looking up an instruction that you might need to take off this length specifier bit to look up the instruction in the Intel manual, which doesn't use these postfixes for length. And if you might come across some Intel syntax stuff. So big difference, destination first. It uses square brackets instead of curly brackets, instead of parentheses. And you've probably seen this in 2150 and maybe remember it. So I'm not going to spend much time on it. So that's all I'm going to say about AT&T syntax, unless there's questions. So are there questions? Well, almost all, but. That I'll go on to another topic. So who here has seen LEA before? So everyone's seen it, but I know from 30 through 30 that there's a lot of confusion about what LEA actually does. So LEA computes an address and then just puts that address in a register without accessing memory. So LEA for RAX to RAX is basically the same as adding 4 to RAX. It's basically the same. It's not quite the same because it turns out addQ sets condition codes and LEAQ doesn't. And when you read code generated by smart compilers, you often see LEA used in surprising ways for not things which are addresses. So for example, this is a way to multiply a value by 5. And if you try to multiply a value by 5 and use a good compiler, it will often generate this. So RAX plus RAX times 4 is the memory address we compute, and we're just taking that address without accessing it and putting it in RAX. Also, a little confusingly, there's a 32-bit version of LEA, which computes the 64-bit address and then truncates it to 32 bits. So you'll see compilers maybe implement adding RBX, EBX plus ECX into EAX. This way, rather than using a couple add instructions and maybe a move. And if you see LEAL on 64-bit, almost certainly we're not computing an address because it doesn't make sense to drop the highest 32 bits if you're computing an address. It's usually, well, often not going to work. So with that mentioned, to make sure that you might remember this stuff, here's a question. So what's the final value of this string here? I would recommend writing things down, probably. And you can check your answer with your neighbor. Yes, question? Okay, I'll go over that first. So in our, this is the equivalency for the syntax. So it's first plus second times third for the things in the parentheses. So it's REX plus REX times four, which is, and you just do distribution, that's REX times five. And yeah, it's not entirely obvious. I would not show that to you and ask, what does this do? And expect you to say, multiplies by five. Okay, so. It doesn't access it. It's the address of that memory address. It's LEA, the important thing is that it never accesses memory. It computes a memory address and does nothing else with it. So this is a computation as if it's a memory address, but it never touches memory.
Yeah.
So who thinks they have an answer? No one, okay. So let's, this may be a little harder than I thought. Also, I probably should have checked what the answer was a little more carefully because it's not what I expected, but. So what does this move queue, this first move queue do? Any volunteers to explain? Yes.
Puts our string into our index.
So this first one? So first thing is the difference in AT&T's index between dollar sign and not. So this one puts our string, the address of our string in RAX. This move to RDX puts the value, the 8 bytes at the string into RDX. Yeah. The 8 bytes at the address, at that label.
So that asks
these? Yeah, this represents characters followed by a null, character. That is not something I intend to test you on. Yeah. So this move queue takes the address of the string and places it in RAX, which is probably good because later on we're using RAX as a memory address several times, and it'd be helpful if it's actually a memory address. Yes. That would fall under not enough info. Yes.
Why for the first one is it taking the address of the string and not the actual string?
This dollar sign represents a number, a constant in the address. So the AT&T syntax rule is that if you don't have a dollar sign in front of it and it's a label, it represents the thing in memory at that label. This might not be as intuitively true as you think because jump is a bit weird, but for moves, it's certainly true. I didn't just put two move instructions that do the same thing at the top of this. Sorry, the Q?
Like move queue
and
move B.
Yeah. These two are the move Q and move B are what are you saying?
It looks like they're doing similar things.
They are doing similar things.
Okay. But is B small?
B is 1 byte.
B is 1 byte and Q is 4?
Q is 8. It takes the first address, which if you were interpreting this as an integer, would be the least significant, but it's a string, so it's the first character. Yeah. Okay, so let's step through a bit of this, unless someone wants to volunteer a final answer. Okay, a couple people, what do you see? So you think it's C, and different thought? Okay, so some people think it's C, and C is almost right. It was my intended answer, but it's not actually the answer. It's actually something else, but it's almost C. Okay, so this first move B here, so in RDX, we have the 8 bytes here, which are these 8 characters. So A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, the ASCII characters. So that's what's in RDX. RAX is the address of the string, the original address. And the first thing we do is we take the first character and move it into BL, which is the lower part of RBX and EBX. Then we add 1 to RBX, which is presumably going to increment BL with this LEAL instruction. Then we copy that thing we added 1 to back to the beginning of the string. So the beginning of the string change should change from A to B. So when we get here, the beginning of the string changes from A to B, but then we take our 8 bytes that we copied and move it to 4 after, so the character E, and we write those 8 bytes starting at this EFGH. So we replace this EFGH with ABCD. And that's where usually you would stop and you say, oh, that matches right there. But this is a move Q. We're writing 8 bytes, because this is an 8-byte register. So we also write the EFGH. So we're actually changing it to BBCD, ABCD, EFGH, which is a problem because we didn't allocate that much space, and we don't know whether there's a null terminator. But the first characters are definitely this, but then we wrote after the end of the string. Yes?
So what did the parentheses around the move B instruction, what are the parentheses around RAX?
They say that memory at the address specified by RAX. We are not copying whatever values in REX to BL. In fact, we couldn't do that because REX is 64 bits and BL is 8. Yes? Okay, so this LEAL, so LEA means load effective address. So it computes an address and then doesn't do anything with it besides put it in a register. And in this case, that register is EBX. And because the destination register is a 32-bit one, we have F. We could also omit that. And the address we're computing is we're saying, let's say RBX was a memory address, and we wanted 1 byte after whatever address that is. So that means we're taking RBX as and adding 1 to it. And then we're storing that in a 32-bit register. In order to do that, we're going to need to chop off the top 32 bits and just ignore that. Yes?
Would there be a null terminator in memory initially?
Yes, so this assembly directive in the assemblers that support it says that store null terminator after the string. I wouldn't expect you to just know that because this is how the assembler chose to work. That's usually what the Z stands for. It's like ASCII and zero is the sort of mnemonic they have. So any other questions about this example? Comments? Further confusion, people do not look completely satisfied. Yeah?
The last one, that 4 and then memory reference of RAX.
Yeah.
Is it take the memory address, add 4, and then dereference that, or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
So we're taking the address of string, adding 4,
and then
putting using memory there. So the 8 bytes of memory starting there. Yes? Yeah.
So you're doing add 1 to, so RBX is pointing, is that the memory that is pointing at?
So so the effect is the same as adding 1 to RBX. But the reason that load effective address looks the way it is that we're reusing the address computation machinery to do that addition. So we're saying, do what you would do to compute an address, which is just add 1 to RBX, if RBX was an address. But we're not ever pretending, as the writers of this assembly, that we think RBX really means a memory address.
So what does RBX have?
It has these ASCII characters in it.
In all of them?
Yeah. It has the lower 8 bits have the first character, and the upper bits we don't know. You're actually adding 1 to the whole thing, but we only end up using the lower 8 bits because that's what we use in this move B.
So when you add 1, it's changing the ASCII
from A to B. Yeah, and possibly the upper bits are changing in some other way that we don't know about. But well, they aren't because there's a 0 in between, so the upper bits are left unchanged.
And then when we move the LEA, we're
moving
that into
EBX,
which is just like where it was.
Yeah. Except we happen as a side effect to chop off the first 32 bits if they were set beforehand. But that's not relevant to the effect of this code besides whether RBX changes.
Okay.
Other questions? Yes.
What exactly does the queue like write? Does it write the upper 4 bits and
move queue here? It tries to write 8 bytes. So if it turns out that memory after this string is not accessible, which is actually extremely unlikely, this might segfault. But that most likely won't happen. It most likely will write to something, but potentially not what we want to, so this is actually kind of emergent. Yes?
So the LDA L1 parentheses RBX?
Yeah.
You said it's one, you add one to RBX. When you say RBX, is that the, because you said it's not, it's a register, so it doesn't have, it's not an address.
Yeah.
What does it add one to?
It adds one to the RBX. So if this was a move, we would then use that value, computed value, one plus RBX as an address. So LEA is doing the same thing the move would do, except it stops when we would access memory. And just takes the value we'd use to access memory. We will view that later. So, other questions, comments? Okay, so I told you about definitive sources for what instructions in assembly do. I'd also like to tell you about definitive sources for calling conventions. So I think everyone here probably has seen the x86-64 calling convention. I'll go over it quickly. But on Linux, this document, which I've linked off the course schedule page and you can find by Googling for it, is the definitive source which says everything you would ever need to know about the calling convention. And a few other things. It's about the application binary interface. So it's about everything besides the instruction set about how executables work. So this is the definitive source, and it also says exactly how the calling convention works, including all the tricky cases that we don't go over in any course that we've, you know, like 2150 or 3330, because they don't come up. And the basic calling convention is that we put the first 6 arguments in these special registers, or the smaller parts of the registers if they aren't 64-bit arguments. We push additional arguments on the stack. We push the return address on the stack, which is kind of a choice x86 made for us because the call and ret instructions are really convenient. We could not use call and ret, but that would be awfully not unfun. And the return value by convention goes in RAX. So this is the most important thing about the calling convention, and I'm bringing it up here again because if you're reading assembly, knowing the calling convention is really helpful if you're reading code that actually follows it. Turns out some malware won't, but where it does, it's really nice because to like work at a function by function level, just like you would when writing the code and figure out what's going on. Another part of the calling convention is saying what the caller and callee save. And that document I showed you also does that. It has the authoritative list of what you need to assume functions might modify or not. So the caller save stuff are the stuff that functions are allowed to use. And it includes the usual stuff. It includes the return value. It includes all the argument registers, even if the function doesn't take that many arguments. You still can't assume the function won't modify those registers. It includes R11 for some reason. And it includes some types of registers that we usually don't talk about that I'm going to mention today, such as the SSC or AVX registers, whatever those are, and the floating point stack, whatever that is. And it also includes condition codes, the things that I remember said were flag set, that things like JNE use to determine whether or not to jump. And you notice that this is basically most things you can think of that the calling convention they've chosen is that the caller must save them. So there's a much smaller list of things that functions must preserve, and that's the stack pointer, the frame pointer, even if you're not using it to store a frame pointer. If you implement a function according to the calling convention, you have to leave the frame pointer the same way it started, and R12 through R15. So this means that you should expect when reading assembly to see something like pushing R12 before using R12 in a function that's just implementing the calling convention. And it's a useful pattern to be able to recognize, to know that no, the function's probably not doing some weird computation on the stack, it just needs to save R12 because that's what the calling convention says to do. And you might also need to save other things if you're as a caller, like R11, because that's what the calling convention says to do. Okay, any questions about sort of this quick review of the calling convention for x86-64? So I think everyone's seen this before and you know the call stack and how these things work. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about some features of x86 which might come up when you're reading code, might not, but I think it's useful to have the full view, especially if I'm gonna refer you to the manuals and then you're gonna say, XMM? What is that? So x86 has two ways to do floating point. There's the legacy way, which is the x87 floating point instruction. You might say, what is the x87? Well, the 386, there was the 286, probably the 286, there was like a 287, which was a floating point coprocessor, which at one point was actually a separate processor. You would buy separately and put in separately in your computer or that would do floating point. And if you didn't have that, well, you have to do floating point the hard way. Where the hard way means someone needs to write code which uses integers to implement everything that floating point does, which is possible, but several hundred times slower. So there are instructions for, which were originally designed to use that, what is called a coprocessor. And these days are built into x86 chips, but they're called the x87 instructions because they were designed for that coprocessor. And they work quite strangely. And this is still common on 32-bit x86 because often you can't assume that this newer version, the SSE instructions, exist. So on 64-bit, the SSE instructions are required, so that's almost always what you'll see used. But x87 is still around, and there's some reasons why you might see 64-bit code using it. So x87 is really weird compared to any sort of instruction set you've seen before. So x87 has 8 floating point registers, which store a floating point value. What size floating point value, you ask? Well, whatever size you've told it to use. It can be an 80-bit one, a 64-bit one, or a 32-bit one, depending on some set. And these are arranged as a stack of registers. So this is a load a floating point value instruction. So it takes a memory location, and it puts it in ST0, pushes it on the stack, and pulls everything else down. And the last thing on the stack just goes away. And all these instructions most of these instructions are going to work with the top thing on the stack and maybe something else you specify using this sort of syntax. Or otherwise, just with the top two things on the stack. If you're familiar with reverse Polish notation, that's kind of how this works. This is a bit non-intuitive, but I assure you that these, even though this looks like a stack, these are registers. It's just registers that have funny names, and the processor keeps track of the index into the stack and lets you use just an offset from that index. Yes?
So if you want something that's not on the top of the stack, you can still get it without popping everything off the top?
There are instructions for moving things around on the stack, just like there are instructions on our normal processors for moving. So some instructions can access things which are not on the top of the stack. Like there's an add instruction which adds the top of the stack to something else on the stack. And you specify the location of the something else.
Even though they're separate registers.
So like there's an add instruction which is where you can say add ST6 to the top of the stack and put the result on the top of the stack. And there's also instructions for moving things around in the stack, just like we have instructions normally for moving things from register to register. So we're not going to deal with much x87 code, but I want you to be aware that there is a stack which doesn't behave like what you're used to, and that you might see instructions typically prefixed with F like this that are dealing with these floating point registers. And you can look up how they work if you need that, but you probably won't. But it's good to be aware that there's this whole extra state in our machines. So, not going to talk about it. Instead, if you see floating point code, you'll probably see SSE code, because that's what we typically want to use. That's what compilers will generate by default on 64-bit, but not on 32-bit. And SSE started as something not to make floating point better in x86, or to get rid of that stupid stack that's, you know, different than everything else, and turns out to be a little bit of a problem for compilers. But it started as a way to do vector instructions, to do multiple additions or multiplications or other operations in one instruction. So SSE registers can store a bunch of numbers. So you have this array of four floats here, and I can load the whole array of four floats, that's 128 bits, into an SSE register with one instruction. This is move PS for move packed signal. Single for single precision floating point. So that moves all these numbers into XMM0. 1, 2, 3, and 4. We add. And we have similarly an add pack signal, which adds these groups of four numbers in these registers all simultaneously. And then if we move that back to a result, we get the addition of each pair going down. So this is what SSE was designed for, and why it was created originally. No one at Intel or AMD decided, God, our instruction set is really, really not intuitive. We should make it simpler. That's not why this exists. It exists because this is faster for things where you can actually take advantage of this add PS instruction and do multiple pieces of arithmetic at the same time. So you see in this XMM register, so there are 16 of them on 64-bit, 8 on 32-bit. It should be 7, not 6, 8. 8 registers in total. And each of them is 128 bits wide. And I showed it holding 4 floating point values. But there's lots of choices as for what you can hold. You can hold 4 floating point values. You can hold 2 double precision floating point values. You can hold integers and do things in multiple integers at once in there. Or you can just hold one 32-bit floating point value or one 64-bit floating point value and just not use any of the other bits. And you will commonly see code that does this. So for example, so these two things are very common. If you just write straightforward floating point code, your compiler often won't be able to figure out how to use the add pack signal, the things which work on multiple floating point things at once. So you'll get code like this, which is moving one single precision floating point number into this 128-bit register, just not using the upper 96 bits. And then add multiplies to the one thing from each of those registers, not using the upper 96 bits of either one. Yes?
It's hard to figure it out.
The compiler is sometimes smart enough to figure this out. It is, for reasons we talked about in 3330, talking about optimizations with loops generally, it is surprisingly hard to do. And so compilers are inconsistent about whether they'll do it. It's often hard to guess whether a compiler will figure out how to do this for you or not. It is a goal to do that because the difference between using add PS and add SS, if your code is really CPU bound, is a factor of 4, which is something the compiler would like to give you in performance when you turn on optimizations, but it doesn't always work out. Okay. So just like we added these whole bunch of registers for doing floating point operations, we have to think about how do we pass floating point numbers to functions. And the Linux choice is that the XMM registers are used for arguments in order. That's just what they chose. And I think they had a similar choice on 32-bit with the floating point stack. Maybe, no, probably just on the stack. But this is the choice they made. They could have done something else. That's where floating point arguments are passed, regardless of whether they're vectors or not. So if you have four floating point arguments to a function, that's going to use four registers, wasting the top 96 bits of each if they're single precision. And another thing you might see when you're reading code for that uses the Linux calling convention is that veridic functions have a slight difference in the calling convention, which is that they're the same as you'd expect, except REX needs to contain, on entry to the function, the number of floating point registers used. I'm not quite sure why they did this, but that's what you'll see. And this will explain something if you look at a call to printf and wonder, why are we moving zero into REX? That's why. And among things you'll see on besides this, so I talked about SSE giving us four things at once. There's an extension which makes this eight things at once, which has a different register name, YMM, and there's a later extension that adds CMM. So that's what you're seeing if you look at that. Okay, so any questions about floating point stuff? Okay, so earlier I showed you our sort of equivalents for AT&T syntax with addressing modes. And from what you've probably seen before, you think that this is basically all the ways I can specify an address on x86, but that's not true. There's a few others. So one other which comes up a bunch and is a little bit weird is displacement in RIP. So what is RIP? What's that register? So IP stands for instruction pointer. In 3330, we usually call this the program counter. So this is a displacement from the program counter. And you use syntax like this, which seems wrong, because why am I adding the address of this label to the program counter? But what this actually does is it encodes, it's the same thing as move queue thing to RIX, except the encoding is different. So if we didn't have this parentheses RIP, we put the actual final address of thing in the instruction. When we have this parentheses RIP, we're going to put the offset from the address, the offset from the program counter, which is the address of the next instruction, in the instruction. And this means that I can relocate this code, that I can move this thing and the code together and it will still work. Whereas previously, if I changed the memory address of thing in the code, I would need to update the code to point to the new location of thing. So here, as long as I keep the offset between thing and this move queue the same, I can move this machine code that's generated from this around arbitrarily. So this is something that's supported on 64-bit x86. It's not supported on 32-bit x86, but it's extremely useful, and you'll see it used a lot because it's much more convenient, it turns out, than actually encoding absolute addresses. So any questions on how this works? Yeah?
So it's encoded as 42 addresses away from the next address?
It's encoded, no. So this encoding is going to give the address of this thing value. So the address of the label. And it's going to code that as whatever the number of bytes this dot 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 represents.
But can thing change in memory, like change location in memory?
It has to be the same relative to move queue. So you can change it as long as you move the code that accesses it the same amount, which is actually something we're going to end up doing operating systems, and we'll end up doing a lot. Yeah.
The relative offset encoding only applies specifically to RIP, or if it would like that would like RAX?
It only applies to RIP. This is a special case. RIP is not a normal register. You can't move things into RIP. But they chose this syntax, and I believe it's actually similar in Intel syntax. Okay, so any other, yes?
In this example, is displacement, is it a label or is it?
So in this case, so if it's a label, it will, the assembler is going to compute the difference, or the linker will compute the difference between the difference for you based on the location the label ends up and the location this move ends up, which is maybe not what you're used to labels doing. So it represents, so when you use a label, it just says do the right thing to make this move instruction access the thing at this label, whatever that is, which in this case is compare it to where this instruction is.
Displacement RIP is just a syntax.
It's the syntax.
Example of move queue thing.
Yeah.
So it's not part of the actual assembly.
It's not part of the actual machine code. I mean, well, the, yeah. So there's a different version opcode for the move instruction that does this, basically. Yeah. And the assembler trick is that when I use a label here, it's going to compute the offset for me. If you actually use a number there, it will actually encode that directly as the offset and not like look at the address that is and do anything with it. Which is important to know because if you look at object dump output, it will often show you the actual offset and not. And it, usually with the label afterward, with the address afterwards that means, but that's what you're seeing. Other questions? People still look. Maybe? Yeah.
Why did you say it would change if you change the distance between the label and the
disk? So the encoding here is the offset from the address of the following instruction. So we look at what byte is here in the generated code, and how many bytes away from here is that? And that's the number that's going to end up in the machine code. There's going to be a 4-byte slot in the machine code. We're going to put whatever that difference was.
Right. But if you added more code in between, the displacement would still calculate it.
So the assembler will calculate it, but if you're working after assembly, you're in trouble. And often what we'll want to do is we'll want to take machine code from a file and load it into memory and have it work. And this is important for when that happens, whether or not you have to fix these things up or not. Okay, so a final note on addressing modes is that we never talk about the addressing modes for jumps. So it turns out you can do jumps based on registers, which you might see now and then. So this is the AT&T syntax for jumping based to the address specified by a register. This is for jumping to the address specified by whatever is in memory at the address specified by a register, and for whatever is in memory at some address specified by a couple registers and a scale. And you might see all these. So just note that this star means use the value from the right, use the value that follows as an address to jump to. That's how AT&T syntax represents that. Yes?
Are the first two the same?
No. So this reads a value from memory, the memory location specified in REX, and then sets the program counter to that value. This one just sets the program counter to REX. So this one is, the second one is more indirect. Other questions? Yes?
Could you sort of like give us like an example of where these are different?
Where these are different?
So like if REX has the memory address for would, so the first one that would go to.
It would set, so it would start executing code at memory address 4. And the second one, it would read an address from memory address 4, say it's a pointer to another function, and go to that function.
So, like, REX has memory address 4, memory address 4 has memory address 5, and then you go.
Yes. Okay. And so, a final oddity of x86 I will get to briefly. Is about how memory works. So if you've taken 30 through 30, you've seen this concept of virtual memory, which is all we need to know for this course, is that the OS sets some mapping from your program addresses to real addresses, and some parts of that mapping trigger errors like segfaults. And in 3330, we learn about page tables, which is the mechanism you'd expect. But x86 has some history for you. So before virtual memory, there was segmentation. And the way segmentation works is that your address has two parts. It has a segment number and an offset. And we have a table where we look up the segment number and get a base address, and we add that to the offsets. And the idea typically was you could have a stack segment, and all your stack addresses would start with a segment number saying, this is the stack. And this would let you resize the stack independently. And this was thought to be convenient, but now no one uses it, except it's a hardware feature of x86 you can't turn off. And this is where the name segmentation fault comes from. So there's also a limit here, and if the offset is bigger than the limit, we give an error saying you're out of bounds. I didn't allocate you that much stack space, or whatever this segment is meant for. So we're not going to worry too much about this, but you're going to see this come up in x86 code. So you might say, but you never talked about segment numbers and addresses, and indeed, we don't. So the addresses you've seen are the offset part. The segment number on x86 comes from elsewhere. So there's some registers which contain an active segment number. So everything that you do with code uses the CS for code segment register. And that's the segment number that's used for those accesses. So when you jump to a location to read the instructions, the processor uses whatever's in the CS register, the code segment register for the segment number, looks it up in this table, and adds the base to that before figuring out what machine code to read based on your jump. And similarly, when you push something on the stack, it reads in the stack segment register and reads a base from that table for where the stack starts. So in all modern operating systems that you know of, CS, SS, DS have a base address of 0. So it doesn't matter. But this will come up in one case where you'll see something like this. So usually, which segment register to use is determined by the kind of instruction. Stack instructions use the stack segment register. Data instructions use the data segment register. Code instructions use the code segment register. And there's a few extra segment registers, which a few special instructions use. Or you can have a segment override. So there's an additional thing in our addresses we can add, which in AT&T syntax is represented as this segment register, in this case FS, colon, and the rest of an address. So this says the segment part of this address is whatever's in segment register FS. So I don't want you to use the normal thing, I want you to use that. And so if you look in the Intel manual, you'll see this picture for how things work, how the address lookup works, which is that we take our logical address, which includes that segment number, usually just implied by the instruction, and we look it up in a segment table, add something to it, get what is called, what the manuals will sometimes call a linear address. This is what linear address means, for which our normal page table stuff, which if you take a 3330 is familiar, if not, just trust me, this is what normal OSs do that lets us set up a mapping for memory. And this is from the instruction and a segment register. So either a segment override or just implied by the instruction. So one reason we care about segments is because it determines user or kernel mode. This is actually stored in the segment table. Just for historical reasons, there's no good reason to do that, but this is where that information is. Basically, what the code segment entry says tells you whether you're in user mode or kernel mode. So you can't get rid of it because operating systems want to change to user mode, and this is how they have to do it. They have to update the segment table to change a bit saying user mode versus kernel mode. But the other reason we're going to care about it is because we're going to use it to store a pointer for thread local data. And you'll see this in code that's generated. It will use one of those extra segments, FS or GS, to access thread local data. So you'll see something like this to write something to thread local storage. FS is basically acting as an extra register to just store a pointer to data for my thread, data for my this current process where I just wanted an extra register. So you'll commonly see that in code that's generated, and that's what it means. So the operating system set up this pointer, and we're using it because we don't have many registers to use. And that's all it's used for. In fact, on 64-bit, that's the only thing you can do with segmentation besides setting the privilege level. Everything else doesn't work. You can change the base, it doesn't do anything except for FS and GS. Because this was a feature being used at the time that 32-bit, the 64-bit extension to x86-32 happened. Okay. And I'm sorry, I'm a little over time. So that's all I have for today. So next time we're going to talk more about what's in actual binaries. And there's an assignment that starts that's out this Friday, which is reading assembly. And hopefully this gives you enough to get started on that.